Pianist Nelson Gurner. Tuesday night from 7:30 on BBC Radio 3.
This is BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and online. Just gone 1 o'clock, time for the news from John Shea.
The Greek government has insisted that it will avoid bankruptcy amid signs that world leaders have begun planning for that eventuality. Athens says it's begun implementing a strict programme to lower its mountain of debt and prevent a default. But finance ministers meeting in Washington are understood to be discussing the use of emergency EU funds to prop up European banks heavily exposed to Greek debt. The chief executive of the Swiss bank UBS has resigned in the wake of the arrest of Kweku Adeboli, an alleged rogue trader from London. A spokesman for UBS said Oswald Grubel felt he had to take responsibility for the bank's losses of £1.5 billion. A mother and five of her children have died in a fire at a house in northwest London. The children's father and his 16-year-old daughter were injured and are being treated in hospital. Russia's president, Dmitry Medvedev, has ended months of speculation by announcing that his predecessor, Vladimir Putin, should return to the presidency. Mr. Putin had already served two terms as president when he became prime minister 3 years ago. Elections are due to take place next year, but Mr. Putin's path to the presidency is all but secure. The armed forces of the Libyan interim government are reported to be moving close to the centre of the city of Sirte, where pro-Gaddafi fighters are still holding out. The Reuters news agency says the forces of the new regime are now less than a mile from the city centre. Witnesses describe huge plumes of black smoke rising above the city. NASA says the 6-ton satellite that fell to Earth this morning entered the atmosphere somewhere over the Pacific Ocean. It's been unable to confirm reports on the website Twitter that some of the debris reached Western Canada. And the weather. It'll be cloudy and damp in parts of northern England, Wales and southwest England, although the rain will ease this afternoon. Scotland and Northern Ireland will be breezy but bright with isolated showers. It'll be dry, bright and rather warm in central and eastern England. The news and weather on BBC Radio 3 at 1:02.
And now the early music show. And on the 400th anniversary of the first performance of Shakespeare's last play, The Tempest, Lucy Skeeping looks back on the music and career of the Bard's great Jacobean musical collaborator, Robert Johnson.
May I be bold to think these spirits?
Spirits, which by mine art I have from their confines called to enact my present fancies.
Let me live here forever. So rare a wandered father and a wise makes this place paradise.
You nymphs called naiads of the winding brooks, with your sedged crowns and ever harmless looks, leave your crisp channels, and on this green land answer your summons. Juno does command. Come, temperate nymphs, and help to celebrate a contract of true love. Be not too late.
Rehearsals for a production of Shakespeare's The Tempest, given by Jericho House Theatre Company in London. Of course, music and theatre have always been natural bedfellows, from the bawdy antics of a travelling troupe or the formality of a court mask to the earliest experiments in opera. Songs and dances added an extra dimension to the dramatic experience, whether as interludes, moments of reflection, or part of the action. And when it comes to Shakespeare, music can often reveal not only a subtext to a scene, but an insight into the very spirit of the age. The man that hath no music in himself, says Lorenzo in The Merchant of Venice, nor is not moved with concord of sweet sounds, is fit for treasons, stratagems and spoils. Let no such man be trusted. Shakespeare, of course, is one of our great national institutions. For him, music certainly had an important role, and perhaps never more so than in the play we've just been hearing, The Tempest. But anyone who's tried to find the original music for Shakespeare's plays will know just how scarce the early settings are, and how hard it is to nail them securely to the very first stage productions. Well, in today's early music show, we are focusing on a musician who is, in fact, the only named contemporary of Shakespeare's, who we know for sure composed music for his plays. The composer who's featured throughout the Jericho House production, Robert Johnson.
Where the bee sucks, there's the heart gone, in a cow
Where the Bee Sucks by Robert Johnson from Act 5 of Shakespeare's The Tempest, performed there by Carolyn Sampson with lutenist Matthew Wadsworth and Mark Levy on the bass viol. Robert Johnson was the son of a musician who served as Queen Elizabeth's lutenist. At the age of 13, like many growing lads, he was sent away to be apprenticed to a nobleman, in this case, the Lord Chamberlain, Sir George Carey. The deal was that Johnson would be a page and in return get board and lodging, clothing and music lessons. The arrangement lasted for the customary 7 years, at which point Johnson, now 21, was deemed suitable and ready for what must surely have been a much sought-after post, as lutenist to the new King of England, James I. After a few years, he became one of the musicians to Henry, Prince of Wales, as well, heading up a band of lutes, viols and voices who performed in the lavish court masques as well as more intimate concerts for the royal inner circle. Musical taste in England may now have been moving towards the lighter French style, but Johnson was also master of the more intense, sombre kind of lute music that, like his contemporary John Dowland, characterised the English tradition. Here's Matthew Wadsworth with Johnson's Pavan No. 1. lutenist Matthew Wadsworth with Pavan No. 1 in C minor by Robert Johnson. It certainly helped that Johnson knew his way around the lute. In fact, he was also responsible for maintaining the king's lute collection, seeing to repairs and strings, and generally making sure they were all in tip-top playing condition. His surviving solo lute pieces, not more than 25 of them, were probably all composed in the first 15 years of the 1600s, and without exception, they really are of great quality. A musician's life at the English court was nothing if not busy. Not only was Johnson lutenist to King James, leader of the Prince of Wales's band, in charge of the upkeep of the royal lute collection, and in between all that, composing his own music, but he also had to be on the move from time to time. Just a year after he joined the royal household, he was amongst a band of 7 trumpeters and other players who accompanied the English ambassador to Austria. Another trip took him out of England for some 3 years. But perhaps it was his contribution to the court masks that kept him the busiest. High-profile multimedia entertainments in which he teamed up with the likes of designer Inigo Jones and scriptwriter Ben Jonson. A little later on, we'll hear some excerpts from The Mask of Oberon, which was certainly one of the most lavish of them. But first, here are 3 dances Johnson composed probably for a mask celebrating the marriage of Princess Elizabeth to the Elector Palatine in 1613. We're told he engaged 20 lutes for the occasion, but in fact this huge army of pluckers included instruments such as the mandora, the cittern, bandora, theorbo and guitar as well, along with lutes of varying sizes and pitches, just the sort of ensemble that was already popular across the Channel in the French court.
Thank you.
Three Mask Dances by Robert Johnson, and the performers there on a variety of plucked instruments were led by the lutenists Jacob Lindberg, Robert Meunier, Nigel North and Paul Odette. Well, we've heard how Johnson was indentured to the Lord Chamberlain, Sir George Carey, and then became a royal lutenist. But this association was to direct him into another world too, outside the court circle. Carey was also the patron of the King's Men, the premier theatrical troupe of the time for which Shakespeare wrote his later plays and also acted in himself as part of the company. They were based at the Globe, and for the winter months they also took over the indoor theatre in Blackfriars. Now the company could really make full use of singing in their plays. After all, solo songs could be pretty well inaudible in the open-air theatres. But here, with a roof to contain the sound, they could be used to real dramatic effect. A change of mood to reveal a character's feelings like melancholy or madness, to underline an ironic or comic situation, or even as some kind of magic spell. And then, of course, there were songs for seduction. Here in Act Two of Cymbeline, we find the ghastly Cloten fed up by his inability to woo his stepsister, Princess Imogen, and using a variety of risque double entendres that continue in the song. Robert Johnson's Hark, Hark the Lark, performed by Emma Kirkby, accompanied on the lute by Anthony Rooley. Some of Johnson's Shakespeare songs set the text to straightforward lyrical melodies like that, but he could often be much more adventurous, declamatory, even operatic in style, like this next song, which comes from The Winter's Tale. Here we find the mischievous peddler Autolycus determined to flog as many ballad sheets as he can to the two innocent shepherdesses Dorcas and Mopsa. The three share this song set by Johnson, Get You Hence.
Get you hence, for I must go where it fits not you to know.
Whither, oh whither,
whither,
it becomes thy awful well, thou to me thy secrets tell.
And me too, let me go thither,
if thou goest to grange or mill,
if to either thou doest ill.
Neither.
What, neither?
Neither.
Thou hast vowed thy love to me.
Thou hast sworn my love to be.
Then whither goest thou, sayest whither?
Nevermore, for Lassa's sake, will I dance and fare or wake?
Sleeping. What
Catherine Bott, Julia Gooding and Stephen Varco, with the Parley of Instruments directed by Peter Holman, performing Robert Johnson's Get You Hence from Shakespeare's Winter's Tale. You're listening to The Early Music Show with me, Lucy Skeeping, and we're exploring the theatre music of Shakespeare's near contemporary, the composer Robert Johnson. And we'll hear the same performers again now, this time as witches and spirits, and showing that when it came to characterisation, Johnson's skills were a perfect match for those of the bard.
Come away, come away, Hecate, Hecate, oh, come away.
I come, with all the speed I may, with all the speed I may. Where's Tadlin?
Here.
Where's Puckle?
And here we do.
We lack but you, we lack but you.
Come away, wake up the count.
I will but anoint, and then I mount, and then I mount, and then I mount.
There's one comes now to fetch his dues, a kiss, a call, a sip of blood. And why thou stayst so long?
I muse, sips the air so sweet and good.
Ah, art thou come? What news?
All goes well to our delight. Either come or else refuse.
Now I'm furnished for the flight. Now I go and now I fight, all in my sweet sprite then I. Oh, what a dainty pleasure is this, to ride in the air when the moon shines fair, and feast and sing and toy and kiss. Over woods I rocks and mountains, over seas are mistress fountains, over steeples, towers and turrets, we fly by night amongst troops of spirits. No ring of bells to Paris sounds, no owls of wolves, nor yelps of hounds, no the noise of waters breach, nor cannons thrown, nor I can reach.
No ring of bells
to Paris sounds, no owls of wolves, nor yelps of hounds.
Come Away, Hecate, followed by The Witch's Dance, Robert Johnson's music from The Witch, a play by Thomas Middleton from the late 17th century that he adapted from the text of Shakespeare's Macbeth. Johnson's work for Shakespeare's company forms an important part of his surviving music, but he also wrote songs for other leading playwrights of the day, often in quite a free style so that the singer could embellish the melody and interact with the lute accompaniment. You can hear that really well in the second song in this set, Care Charming Sleep. It's from Fletcher's play Valentinian, which tells the story of one of the last Roman emperors and his slow death by poisoning. And just a couple of years later, when the public were mourning the unexpected death of Prince Henry, the song was taken up as an elegy for him. After that, we're going to hear a song from Webster's The Duchess of Malfi. This is really dramatic stuff, Johnson at his most adventurous, introducing elements of distortion and what you might call anti-melodic features. After all, these songs weren't written to please the music lover in his chamber, but to really have an impact in a dramatic theatrical situation. But first, what I think is one of Johnson's most touching songs, written for Ben Jonson's play The Devil Is an Ass. Have you seen the bright lily grow before rude hands have touched it? Have you marked the fall of the snow before the soul hath smutched it? Oh, so white, so soft, so sweet is she.
Have you seen the bright lily grow before rude hands have touched it? Have you marked the fall of the snow before the soil smutched it? Have you felt the wool of beaver or swan's down ever? Or have smelled of the bud of the briar or the nod in the fern? Or have tasted the bag of the bee? Or so white, or so soft, or so sweet, so sweet, so sweet is she? Do but look on her eyes, they do light all that love's world compriseth. Do but look on her head, it is bright as love's star when it riseth. Do but mark the forehead smoother than words that soother, and from her arched brow such a grace shuts itself through the face as along the triumphs to the life. All the gain, all the good, all the gain, the good of the end and strife. Care, charming sleep, thou easer all woes.
Oh, Let Us Howl by Robert Johnson, performed by David Thomas with Anthony Rooley on the lute. Before that, we heard Carolyn Sampson and Matthew Wadsworth in Johnson's Care Charming Sleep from Fletcher's play Valentinian. And to begin the set, Have You Seen the Bright Lily Grow, performed by Johannette Sommer with lutenist Fred Jacobs. As we've heard, away from the public playhouses, Johnson, a royal musician till his death in 1633, was very much involved in the court masks. We're going to hear a sequence of excerpts from Ben Jonson's Mask of Oberon, written for New Year's Day 1611. As usual, it was designed to flatter the monarch, impress foreign visitors and generally affirm the status quo. The 16-year-old Prince Henry played Oberon, the costumes were sumptuous, the scenic effects were breathtaking, and a large and exotic group of singers and instrumentalists accompanied it all. In this case, a band of 75, no less. A series of dances began the entertainment, and then a fanfare signalled the opening of the rock. A sketch made by designer Inigo Jones shows a craggy mountain from which emerged a chorus of satyrs who sing a catch, buzz, buzz, quoth the blue fly. We'll then hear two songs by Robert Johnson, alternating with two of his dances.
Oh,
a sequence of pieces from The Mask of Oberon, which included music by Robert Johnson. And the performers were the musicians of The Globe, directed by Philip Pickett. So Robert Johnson was highly regarded in the royal court and was also a wonderful servant to the many great playwrights and poets of his day, not least Shakespeare. In his later years, he may well have concentrated more on lute music. And it's a shame that so little of it survives, because it represents what really was the culmination of England's golden age for the instrument. Amongst his colleagues, he was also well respected, spoken of in the same breath as the now more famous John Dowland, as composer Thomas Mace wrote some years later. "Despair I do, old Dowland is dead, Robert Johnson too, two famous men, great masters in my art." Let's end with another of Johnson's great song settings from Shakespeare, Full Fathom Five from The Tempest, beautifully performed by Robin Blaise and Elizabeth Kenny. And it's nice to think that Robert Johnson may even have influenced the bard himself over the 6 or 7 years he was associated with the King's Men. It's a view taken by Jonathan Holmes, the director of Jericho House Theatre Company, who we heard at the beginning of the programme. His current production of The Tempest makes a real feature of Robert Johnson's music.
The Tempest is Shakespeare's most musical play. There are several scenes that are almost entirely underscored or through-scored. In total, music accounts for between a third and a half of the play's entire length. And this is considerably greater proportion of music than in any other play of the period by Shakespeare or by anybody. So there clearly is an attempt by the King's Men with this play to do something that is sonically new and different to what had gone before. The music world that the play is connected to is the one that flourished at the time at Whitehall. The play was first performed at Whitehall in 1611. It was part of a programme of masques in that year, and the person we know that was most connected with it was Robert Johnson, who was the person, along with Alfonso Ferrabosco, most responsible for the masque music happening in Whitehall at the same time. So there seems to be a very explicit connection between the work that Johnson is doing in the masque and the work that Johnson is doing in Tempest. And we know from the accounts at court and from the identities of the musicians involved that there was a very large contingent of musicians, a very large ensemble that Johnson had on call to work on the masks. And it seems from the stage directions in The Tempest and from the textual indications within the play that a similar roster of musical talent was involved in The Tempest. So this leads us to think that something very similar to the mask world was being deployed for The Tempest. The music in The Tempest falls roughly into three categories. There are the songs, which we know that Johnson wrote. There's also the accompanying dance music, other jigs and moments like that in the play. And then there's a third category of music that we would perhaps today call foley, following from film. So it's music that characters sometimes hear and respond to and sometimes don't, but which drives the narrative of the play. And this is what's particularly interesting, because this is what's new. What seems to have been key with The Tempest and also with The Winter's Tale, which is precisely contemporary, is the influence of Robert Johnson himself. We know that Robert Johnson wasn't involved in other late Shakespeare plays except possibly Cymbeline. His involvement is limited at the most to those three plays. And those three plays are considerably more musical than any other plays in Shakespeare's repertoire. So there is obviously a relationship there between the King's Men, Shakespeare and Robert Johnson that's leading to an increased musical world in these plays, and which does not extend, despite all the other factors, to the other late romances and the other late plays. So there does seem to have been a collaborative relationship that's very fruitful between those two individuals.
Nothing of him that doth fail.
Jonson's Full Fathom Five from Shakespeare's The Tempest, performed by Robin Blaise with the lutenist Elizabeth Kenny. Today's early music show was presented by Lucy Skeeping and was produced by Chris Wines.
It's 1952. You're standing among the racks of LPs, remember those? In the flagship store of Liberty Record Shops at the junction of Madison Avenue and 50th Street in Manhattan. You're browsing idly through the discs when one of the clerks puts on a record of music that has everyone around you stand stock still and listen. Imagine hearing this for the very first time. Yes, there was a time not so long ago when virtually no one on the planet would have known the name Antonio Vivaldi. He's my composer of the week, every weekday this week at noon, and again in the evening at 6:30 here on BBC Radio 3.
Well now, another chance to hear last Monday's live Wigmore Hall concert. The presenter is Louise Fryer.
Viennese pianist Till Fellner has gained a reputation for interpreting masterpieces of the Central European repertoire, so it seems entirely apt that he'll be beginning this lunchtime recital from Wigmore Hall with a sonata by Haydn, and includes music from 19th century Germany, Schumann's Kindertszenen, or Scenes of Childhood, and from Hungary, Liszt, episodes from the great pianist composer's Année de Pèlerinage. While Liszt is credited with the very concept of the piano recital, Haydn laid much of the groundwork when it came to putting the piano centre stage. He produced more than 60 keyboard sonatas over a span of about 40 years, gradually elevating the form from drawing room fare to substantial, impressive works aimed at public performance. And his sonatas proved especially popular with the ladies. In the 1780s, when the forte piano began to overtake the harpsichord, Haydn was responsible for encouraging Vienna's noble women into making the switch. Like Liszt, Haydn developed a taste for travel, and Till Fellner is going to be playing one of Haydn's last sonatas, composed in the mid-1790s during his second trip to London. It's particularly demanding, designed to show off the greater dynamics of the new Broadwood pianos that were appearing in England at the time, and it was dedicated to a particularly skillful pianist resident in London, Teresa Jansson, who was a star pupil of Clementi and had distinguished herself on the concert platform. Haydn was a witness at Teresa's wedding to a London art dealer, Gaetano Bartolozzi. This sonata in C major, Hoboken 16, number 50, is one of three Haydn dedicated to Teresa Jansson. It's typically witty in the outer movements, while the middle movement, Adagio, is surely one of Haydn's most expressive. A good thing, then, that in a recent interview, Till Fellner claims that for him, emotion is the most important thing. It's the feeling, he says, that comes first. And here is the Austrian pianist to begin this lunchtime recital of Haydn's Piano Sonata in C major, Hoboken 16, number 15.
Thank you.